I think we can start now and others can join as and when they like. First of all, massive thanks to Ricardo for giving some of his time to talk to us today. Ricardo, together with Georgos Kallis and Jason Hickel, were really crucial in bringing the post-growth perspective into our paper and in bringing us on board with the ideas that continued expansion of energy demand and continued expansion of consumption isn't going to allow us to achieve a just transition and a transition that's adequate to the scale of the challenge unless we also decrease material throughput, decrease aggregate energy demand, and then substitute that lower demand, with renewable sources of energy and with more sustainable means of manufacturing. So I guess maybe I'll leave it at that, and I'll hand it over to Ricardo, just because I imagine the background's really noisy here. Ricardo, take it away, please.
All right, thanks, Pavel. So good evening, everybody. And my name is Riccardo Mastini. I'm a PhD candidate at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, and I'm working on research concerning climate stabilization in a post-growth scenario. And so I've been currently working on a paper looking at how the Green New Deal narrative can inform and be informed by the growth and post-growth theory. So I was very pleased when along with Jason and Yorgos, we were invited to contribute to the Green New Deal for Europe platform, because I think it's a really worthwhile project to trying to bring some of this idea out. I prepared a little presentation for tonight, no PowerPoints, I have a few talking points. And I can share it actually afterwards. So what I'm going to talk about is, let's say, post-growth ecological transition and what that would look like. So let's say that the four logical steps that I'll be following will be first sketching out the limits of the decoupling and green growth discourse. Then I'll move on looking at how and why reducing energy and material use is needed for rapid decarbonization. And the third step will be that this will probably entail a downscaling of aggregate economic activity. And hence, last point of my presentation will be some policy proposals for managing without growth. Please feel free to interrupt me during the presentation if some things are not clear, or just tell me to slow down if I'm going too fast. And it's lots of ground to cover, so I hope you will at least get the gist of some of our analysis. So I would start off with saying that the problem with the existing Green New Deal discourse is that it doesn't address the paradox of growing energy demand. Over the past few years, scientists have been warning that we may fail to reach our climate goals even with the most aggressive efforts, because global economic growth is driving energy demand up at a pace that's outstripping our ability to install clean power. For instance, today the world is producing 8 billion more megawatt hours of clean energy each year than in the year 2000. That's quite a lot, enough to power all of Russia. But over the exact same period of time, economic growth has caused energy demand to increase by a staggering 48 billion megawatt hours. So 48 billion megawatt hours in increase in total energy use, and just 8 billion of this is covered by clean power. So in other words, all the new clean energy we have rolled out covers only a small fraction of new demand. That's why emissions keep rising. It's like shoveling sand into a hole that just keeps getting bigger. And this problem is going to eventually cripple us. If we continue growing the global economy at existing rates, it will nearly triple in size by the middle of the century. That's 3 times more production and consumption than we are already doing right now, which will require nearly 3 times more energy. I would say that it's difficult enough for us to decarbonize the existing global economy, well, and virtually impossible to do it 3 times over. But what's the answer to this apparent paradox? What's the answer offered by the green growth discourse? Well, just one magic word: decoupling. Decoupling touts efficiency as a recipe for more goods and services at a lower environmental cost. I must say that there is no a priori reason why efficiency cannot increase faster than scale, or even as fast as necessary to reduce impact to a sustainable level. We have to admit this. Insofar as GDP measures what people are willing to pay for things, as opposed to the amount of energy and resources that people actually consume, there is no reason why the economy cannot, in theory, grow using progressively less energy and resources. We can imagine people's preferences shifting to goods and services with ever lower energy and material requirements. Hence, one may conclude that the decoupling should theoretically be possible. And in fact, this is precisely the reason that advocates of green growth are not deterred by claims that it has not yet happened and does not seem likely to happen in the future. They basically attribute this to lack of effort. But we need at this point to sketch a distinction between relative and absolute decoupling. So relative decoupling refers to a decline in the ecological intensity per unit of economic output, so GDP. The use of energy and raw materials does not decline in absolute terms in the case of relative decoupling. So impacts may still increase, but they do so at a slower pace than growth in GDP. This is an attainable goal, as the capitalist system is good at increasing efficiency in production because resource inputs represent a cost to producers. On the contrary, absolute decoupling is brought about when ecological resource use declines in absolute terms over time. And this latter situation is essential if economic activities to remain within ecological limits. And the validity of the green growth discourse relies on the assumption of an absolute, permanent, global, large and fast enough decoupling of GDP from all critical environmental pressures. So it's not enough that we register a limited form of decoupling for some environmental impacts for a limited amount of time. We must look at it in a more broader perspective. So the problem is that there is no empirical evidence for such a decoupling having ever happened. So let it be for materials, energy, water, greenhouse gases. Decoupling, absolute decoupling is either is observed only temporarily or only locally. And when absolute decoupling occurs, it is observed only during a rather short periods of time and concerning only certain resources. However, in spite of all the evidence, one may insist nonetheless that green growth hasn't occurred because it has not been tried. We haven't tried hard enough. And the fact empirically observed till now becoming somehow irrelevant in the discussion. So, as I was saying, indeed, it cannot be proven that absolute decoupling is theoretically impossible, at least not as long as ultimate limits in efficiency and substitution have not been reached. As a result, our only reliable guide to the decoupling question must be empirical. And existing empirical studies demonstrate that green growth is at best highly unlikely. Therefore, I would argue that we should follow instead a more precautionary approach. Policy should be made on the basis of robust empirical evidence rather than on the basis of speculative theoretical possibilities, particularly given the severity of the crisis that is at stake. And so a recent research pointed out that absolute decoupling of GDP from emissions is unlikely to happen fast enough to respect the carbon budgets for 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius against a background of continued economic growth. All the models that successfully project global GDP growth at 2-3% per year, while maintaining us, maintaining the global economy within the carbon budgets, rely heavily on negative emissions technologies that are either unproven or dangerous at scale, such as BECCS and others. So what's actually the connection, therefore, between GDP growth and the climate emergency? Well, a lower rate of GDP growth requires a lower rate of reduction of carbon intensity. So without negative emission technologies, a growth rate of 0% at the global level requires decarbonization of 6.8% per year to stay within the 1.5 carbon budget and 4% per year for the 2 degrees Celsius carbon budget. So almost 7% decarbonization per year for the 1.5 carbon budget and 4% per year for the 2 degrees carbon budget. We must acknowledge that there is no empirical evidence that 7% of decarbonization can be achieved on a global scale. There are no precedents of such a high degree of decarbonization. But 4% is nearly within reach. In other words, it is empirically feasible to achieve green growth within a carbon budget for 2 degrees with the most aggressive possible mitigation policies if the growth rate is basically close to zero, let's say less than 0.5% per year. However, emission reductions in line with the 1.5 degrees of the carbon budget are not empirically feasible except in a scenario in which we scale down aggregate economic activity. So if we contend ourselves with keeping within the 2 degrees Celsius carbon budget, we can pursue some sort of zero growth scenarios. Whereas if actually we want to maintain the global economy within the 1.5, we need a strategy of scaling down aggregate economic activity because the degree of decarbonization at 7% per year is technologically unlikely to happen. But before continuing in my analysis, I'd like to address a typical criticism aimed at those who question the desirability and sustainability of continued economic growth, namely that growth is not unsustainable if it happens in green sectors. So that's a usual criticism that I receive. Well, what a good answer to this is that it's aggregate growth that it's at stake. So if we refer to just growth in industries, in green industries that are necessary for a rapid energy transition, while industries that are socially unnecessary and eco-destructive shrink at the same time with an aggregate zero growth or even contraction scenario, then that would be fine. So in the sense that when you talk about shrinking the economy or not growing the economy, you're looking at it at an aggregate level. But of course, certain sectors within the economy can still expand. But it is fanciful to think that there is one type of growth that is bad, regressive, dirty, and another type of growth that instead could be inclusive, progressive, clean. This is because growth is an integrated process. And no matter what the ideologues of green growth claim, there is no proof that we can grow the economy by selectively growing the goods while decreasing the bads. Armaments, advertising, fossil fuels, planned obsolescence, and waste of all kinds are integral to capitalist growth. Since its beginning in colonial Britain, growth has been fueled by unequal exchange of labor and resources between imperial centers, both internal and external. So between imperial centers and peripheries, both within countries at the world level. So growth requires the investment of surplus for the creation of more surplus. And this surplus is created by exploiting wage workers and appropriating the unpaid work of women, foreigners, and nature. Shifting of costs in space and time has also been central, as David Harvey pointed out. Access to low-cost labor and resources is vital for economic growth to continue. Indeed, if inputs become more expensive, then the economy slows down. Building a green economy entails more labor-intensive activities, and the private sector does not invest in renewables because they have low profit margins. Therefore, shifting financial resources from high productivity and high profit sectors to low productivity ones is not a recipe for growth. Besides the energy productivity of renewables, the so-called energy return on energy invested, is also lower than that of fossil fuels. An economy of low productivity, low profits, and low energy returns is unlikely to be an economy that grows. And this is fine, since our priority right now should be to decarbonize rather than to grow the economy. This being said, one may argue that growth is the only way to mobilize the financial resources necessary for the energy transition. And the only way to get the technological innovation we need in order to make our economies more efficient. But it doesn't make sense to grow the GDP and just blindly hope that it will end up invested in solar panel factories. If that's how the Allies had approached the need for tanks and aircraft during World War II, well, the Nazis would be in charge of Europe right now. On the contrary, the kind of mobilization required that is required right now is government policy to guide and direct existing financial resources. And if the objective is to achieve specific kinds of technological innovation, it makes more sense to invest in those directly or incentivize innovation with targeted policy measures rather than to grow the whole economy indiscriminately and pray for a specific outcome. Think about it. Is it really reasonable to grow the plastic industry, the timber industry, and the advertising industry in order to get more efficient solar panel? Does it really make sense to grow dirty things in order to get clean things? I would say no. And more specifically, if we look at an investment at the level of 2, 3, even 5% of GDP per year, this does not require deficit spending. Assuming that there is the political will for such a program, it could be financed by replacing dirty or socially useless investment, such as armaments, and by increasing the top marginal tax rate. If there is no deficit spending and debt, there is no need to stimulate growth to pay it back. And just like a GDP, growth would not be necessary for financing a Green New Deal, so it would not be a result of it. Without deficit spending, there is no reason why a clean investment program will cause growth, since the GDP percentage that will go to renewables would have gone to some other investment. So this doesn't, that would not determine the economy to grow altogether. Moving on, some considerations on the desirability of growth, I would say that the good news is that rich countries don't need more growth in order to improve people's lives. We already have enough income. The problem is that it's captured at the top. If we share what we already have more fairly, we can improve people's lives right now without having to plunder the earth for more. Fairness is an antidote to the growth imperative, just like growth arose in the 30s as a way of diffusing social conflicts and increasing people's livelihoods without redistribution. Now fairness can be an antidote to our growth recipes. People already, I think, realize that growth isn't improving lives. Consider that in the US, the poverty rate is worse and real wages lower now than they were in the 70s, despite a doubling of GDP per capita. And also, if you were to compare Europe and the US, Europe outperforms the US on every social indicator, despite its GDP per capita being 40% lower. So, while a post-growth ecological transition is not about reducing GDP, so our target is not to reduce GDP, but it's actually about avoiding ecological breakdown and ensuring people's well-being, the result most likely will be a contraction of the economy. And therefore, we must set up policies that ensure human well-being and equality in a non-growing economy. If I were to just sketch out, let's say, the logical steps of a post-growth ecological transition, I would say that the first one in our reasoning is to stop climate change, we not only need to clean production, but also to reduce and transform consumption. This leads to the consideration that climate policies are currently not being adopted because of their supposed negative impacts on growth. Therefore, we have to pursue them independently of whether or not they are good for the economy, because we put people before the economy, we put sustainability before the growth of the economy. Therefore, we have to develop a process of adaptation to the stagnation of the economy, which prioritizes ecological sustainability, human well-being, and social equality. So we don't target the GDP. We are targeting social and ecological indicators. But if our hypothesis is correct, then probably the economy will take a hit. It won't keep on growing because of all the considerations I just explained. And therefore, we must start thinking in terms of how to stabilize the economy in a context of stagnation, if not contraction. Reducing energy use requires not only energy efficiency, unlike with the green growthers assume, but also support for low energy lifestyles and legislation against energy intensive equipment and planned obsolescence. In scaling down energy demand, aggregate resource use and emissions, we should start first with rich, high-consuming nations and do this while improving people's well-being in these countries. How can we make this happen? Well, I would say that there are five proposals that we could start with. The first one is to abandon GDP as a measure of progress. There is no shortage of alternative socioeconomic indicators that mirror much better the development and improvement of our society rather than GDP that simply measure the speed and the size of our economy. The second proposal will be to scale down energy use. I think that to do this, it is imperative that governments target this objective in a direct way. For example, with the introduction of a cap on aggregate energy demand or on carbon emissions. Part of this reduction in energy use can be achieved through more efficient products, but given rebound effects, this is not a fail-safe approach. We should factor in a certain degree of rebound that in certain cases it can actually lead to backfire, so actually a rebound of 100% or more. So I would say that a more robust approach is to reduce material throughput, which in turn reduces energy demand. And this can be done, so the reduction in throughput in material use can be done by legislating for longer lasting products, such as, for example, by banning planned obsolescence, introducing a right to repair, mandatory recyclability, mandatory long-term warranties, and then also through a shift from private provisioning to public provisioning, such as public transportation instead of private cars, public water instead of bottled water, etc. There are many other examples, we can discuss them later as well. And this approach to reducing material throughput has the added benefit of releasing pressure on also other environmental impacts, such as biodiversity loss. The third policy proposal that I would put forward is to shorten the working week and distribute available work more equally in order to ensure full employment. Not only does a shorter working week have all sorts of positive ecological and social benefits, but it also relieves pressures for growth. In fact, in the existing economy, as labor productivity improves, people get laid off. And we have to generate more growth in order to create new jobs and mop up unemployment. By shortening the working week allow us to create jobs without the need for growth by just redistributing the available work. It also ensures that if aggregate economic activity slows down, then workers laid off from dying, dirty industries can get jobs in cleaner ones, even as total labor requirements diminish. The fourth proposal I would put forward is to distribute national income more fairly. So use the proceeds of taxes and of the above mentioned fees on resource use, emissions and waste to, first of all, help fund the rapid rollout of renewable energy infrastructure, and second, to contribute to a universal basic income, and third, to invest in public goods. The fifth and last proposal that I would put forward is the one is of expanding universal social goods and reinstate the commons to ensure that people can access the resources they need in order to live well without high levels of income. This means generous, high-quality public health care and education, rent controls, affordable public housing and transportation, and access to public parks and recreational facilities. It could also mean a system of universal basic services instead of universal basic income. That's a discussion that we can have. So the idea is that if people depend less on their income generated from the market economy, so if the basic services and goods for life are decommodified, this would also take a take off pressure for more growth and reveal the clear gap that there is between the aggregate economic growth and what instead are the basic services and goods that are actually would determine quality of life and access to the necessary necessities of life. I would like to finish this brief presentation with one key point, which is that we should not confuse a post-growth ecological transition with eco-austerity or austerity in general. Because think about it. The whole point of austerity is to slash public goods in order to restart economic growth with devastating consequences for the poor. Austerity is a violent expression of our system's need for endless growth. Basically, slashing public sectors that don't contribute to economic growth in order to free up financial resources that can be redirected to other sectors that instead drive growth. So basically depriving people of those essential services that we were talking about in order to target it towards sectors that instead create profits and therefore GDP growth. So instead of eco-austerities, post-growth calls for an end of austerity and calls for redistribution in support of public goods, for example, in order to render growth unnecessary to meet people's needs. I think that a post-growth narrative can really name the violence of the growth imperative and calls for something better. So these are some of the key aspects that I wanted to sketch out before having a discussion with you. I hope that it was clear. There was lots of ground to cover. And of course, I realized I didn't go very deep into certain aspects that maybe you would like to have clarified. But I just wanted to limit the time of my presentation and cover as much ground as possible. So I would be happy to have a discussion now on this.
Okay. Thanks, Ricardo, first of all, for the great presentation. And yeah, you said you have like another half an hour, right?
Just to absolutely. Yeah, until 8. Okay,
so another half an hour for questions and input. So I think since we're not too many, if anyone has a point or question, just go forward, please.
All right, maybe I'll start. Thank you so much, Ricardo, for that. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yeah.
My first question is really, if we zoom out and think about this from a multilateral perspective, where you know the institutions of global multilateralism are propagating exactly the kind of economic orthodoxies and ideologies that you're calling to end. So things like the IMF and the World Bank. And when we talk about degrowth, especially in wealthy countries, in high GDP countries, that presumably has to still accommodate some measure of growth in countries that need it, in countries that are far behind, that have been held back by you know colonialism and neocolonialism and all that. So how would you see, or what kinds of, in what ways would you recalibrate the multilateral space to allow for a kind of international management of relative growth and degrowth between the kind of global north and global South writ large?
Yeah, thanks for your question. Indeed, this aspect of ecological debt and different levels of development is something that absolutely needs to be addressed. I was looking at some sort of aggregate level. So indeed, when we talk about zero growth or we talk about degrowth, that is seen, let's say, in a global perspective. But then within this global perspective, indeed, there are countries where a certain degree of material consumption does need to increase, because that correlates still with human well-being. So whereas in OECD countries, we know that further increases in disposable income does not really contribute to human well-being. In other countries, it does. So absolutely, the point is that we need to liberate ecological space specifically for certain countries to increase to a certain degree resource use. However, I would say that the validity of the growth analysis or the growth, approach is not limited to countries that are already, wealthy beyond what is what we would understand as really contributing to human well-being. But I would say that the growth has a role to play wherever the growth ideology exists, in the sense that even in countries in which it's understandable that we should pursue a certain degree of exemption of consumption, why would these have to follow the same patterns that were followed by Europe or North America or other OECD countries, in the sense that if we do understand that we want to increase life expectancy and access to clean water and all the rest, I think that we should challenge the idea that what we need is overall economic growth, and then some of it will trickle down through, for example, taxation into the financing of public services. I think that we needed to have a form of planned, development, so that we can directly use this increasing throughput in order to address people's needs rather than just growing the economy indiscriminately and hoping that some of it will actually benefit the vast majority of people. If then your question verged more on a geopolitical perspective and so on, I must say that that is ground on which I am less comfortable to talk about. Jason has been doing lots of work in that respect, so probably he would be able to contribute better ideas to this debate. But If there is something more specific that you want to ask me, maybe I can address that.
I mean, thank you very much for your very elaborated of the papers we were we received the links to, and I'm more or less overwhelmed about what you have been working on and proposing. I ask myself. Mainly, I mean, the five points you have been giving, abandoned GDP growth as an objective and scale down and so on. Do you see any movements in Europe, in some of the countries at least, who are working in that direction? I think, for example, I think this point of scaling down energy use is even maybe a little bit followed up by the EU in terms of improving different technologies. I think that is a good step to do it, to reduce energy consumption of different household tools. But I mean, even though it's a small step, I think there is something. And I ask myself, where do you see any movements in the directions you have been giving with your five points?
Yes, well, I think that good signs come from, example, from the UK. The Labour Party just had their Congress, 2-3 weeks ago, and in their program, I think that there are some elements that are very promising, such as wartime reduction and universal basic services. So I think that progressive movements, and I'm based in Barcelona, as I was saying, and here there are two progressive parties that have been incorporating the idea of wartime reduction in their Green New Deal, so Más País and Podemos. So I think that the progressive parties are increasingly be listening to this kind of proposals. I think that there is an element that is still taboo, which is the one of some sort of cap on energy use and any form of redistribution that we need to do within the cap. I think that's a deep cultural transformation that that will require a considerable amount of time and efforts, in the sense that indeed there is this approach to, let's say, operating on the demand side, so trying indeed through either taxation, so incentives, so various form of market-based policy instruments, or on regulation to decrease indeed the energy use of appliances and so on and so forth. However, I think that all in all, we are running out of time for this kind of tinkering, in the sense that if we look at energy use and the emissions, especially if we factor in imported, let's say embedded energy and embedded emissions from imports, we just realize that the average European citizen is increasing their energy footprint. So while actually their energy use decreases, their energy and carbon footprint actually expand. So I think that if the science is clear, if we have a clear understanding of what the carbon budget is, I think that the fail-safe approach is the one of setting a cap and then finding a way of redistributing that that amount of energy and of emissions in the most in the fairest way that we can. There has been some proposals. I was in the European Parliament last year at the post-growth conference that helped organize, and they talked about these tradable energy quotas developed in the UK by the Fleming Policy Institute, or carbon allowance. So I think there are a series of schemes that are being currently under development, but I think that that is still a big taboo that we have not been able to approach. So, for example, I see progressive parties that are starting talking about certain policies that will be necessary: wartime reduction, universal basic services, etc. And those are important tenets that we need to establish, because the moment in which we will finally, I think, understand the need of adopting a cap, a declining cap on emissions, at that point, I think that the old green growth fantasies will unravel. And in order to maintain political acceptability and social support for these policies, we must have these other ones in place. So I would say that in a way, why this is a taboo, I understand that this way of proceeding is somehow necessary, in the sense, first we need to liberate people's dependence from the market before we can actually start shrinking the energy base that underpins this market metabolism, the social metabolism. So I don't know if I answered the question, but these are some thoughts off the top of my head.
Thank you. I've got one more question, and I'm sure you would have seen, and in fact, I might have seen it on your Twitter. A couple of weeks ago, the governor of the Bank of England, England's central bank, was asked about whether growth can continue in a finite world, whether he agrees with Greta Thunberg's statement that we need to, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And the response he gave was that you can continue to have growth, but in a sense, virtual growth, growth based on increasing frequency of financial transactions, increasing activity of the financial sector, stuff like derivatives, stuff, that increases wealth in aggregate, but is entirely disconnected from material throughputs and energy use. Now, I know that that's not entirely true, given the financial industry's role in propagating environmental and climate destruction, but how would you respond to that claim?
I am actually, yes, I agree. I tweeted about it. I was actually looking it up, and well, I think that I mean, these fantasies of dematerialization are, you know, this idea of some sort of metaphysical growth. It's really, I think, the only argument that is somehow left to economists defending growth. So basically some sort of growth in some sort of virtual reality. I think that there are some clear limits to it. And as I was saying, it really gets a really tricky argument that you cannot, I think, theoretically, at least I haven't found a way of theoretically win this kind of argument, because I think this verges around some sort of theory of value, in the sense that as long as what we measure with value is people's preferences, indeed, you can have a constant increase in some form of value, some sort of wealth, without this determining increase in emissions. Because if these are disconnected from its metabolic base, these preferences can just shift. And instead of buying more stuff, I might decide to spend more on a cinema. I think that the only appeal I can say, like, the only way I can answer to this is let's look at some historical trends and some empirical evidence, in the sense that supposedly, you know, like, I mean, in the moment in which there is a growth of in the size of the economy, part, at least part of it, will be spent, will be consumed. So as long as we are increasing, purchasing power as some sort of aggregate value, some part of it will be saved, but some part of it will be spent. And this is basically what we are seeing in our economies. And so I think that in the condition we are now, the burden of proof falls on those supporting green growth to find in any point in time some historical trends that point to a moment in which GDP grew without the metabolic base growing as well. I think the burden of proof is on them. We need to adopt a precautionary principle, and given the very limited time that we have for action, I think we should prioritize. Then, you know, if we are wrong, and indeed we can decrease the material and energy use while the economy keep growing, well, I mean, that's good. But let's target decreasing energy and material use. That's why I would say that the growth is not about reducing GDP. The growth is about reducing the social metabolism. Our hypothesis, our assumption is that the GDP will decrease as well, and so we need some policies for managing without growth. But how come we have not been able to prioritize policies, environmental policies, over the past 20, 30 years? Well, because I think that behind the rhetoric of this absolute decoupling, there is an awareness of the fact that this is probably not going to happen, that it's probably going to take a hit on the economy. And so that's why we've been procrastinating, and we have been, I think, debating on some sort of like abstract theories that are very, very hard, I think, to disprove. I think this being said, I think that there are also, I suggest everybody to check out this report that was published during the summer, authored by a bunch of very good scientists, and it was published by the European Environmental Bureau. The title of the report is Decoupling Debunked, and there are several reasons listed why the amount of decoupling that we have observed so far in OECD countries is determined to fade away, in the sense that even the degree in which we have been able to decouple in GDP from the metabolic base of the economy, it's going to get harder and harder now, because, you know, there has already been a shift to services as much as probably was feasible in our economies. And other reasons like that, or the low energy return of renewable energy. So you need to invest more energy in order to get out a unit of energy compared to fossil fuels. Well, that's not a recipe for growth, because growth always depends on expanding the energy base. So if your energy base shrinks, that's very hard to imagine. Then, of course, if we just think in terms of some sort of non-physical asset value and so on, well, yes, it could grow maybe forever, but then it could not really then find a way of being spent in the real economy to purchase goods and services and increase a certain lifestyles and stuff like that. So I don't know if I've answered in a satisfactory way your question. It's a difficult one.
So does anyone else have any other questions? I've got another difficult one, but maybe open the door to others.
Some easy questions, please.
Okay, maybe I'll just shoot with mine. So okay. I really liked how you've described austerity as this slashing of the public sector to make growth for growth industries, to make space for profit industries, which then generate GDP growth. And if you talk about the idea of kind of post-growth or degrowth in the hands of neoliberals and in the hands even of some scientists, it expresses itself as eco-austerity, the kind of eco-austerity described, and in a way kind of tends to be a gateway drug to eco-fascism, because you have many of the same people who are talking about eco-austerity who talk about, well, we need to have population control, we need to have a China-style one child, you know, one family policy, all of that kind of stuff. And this is gradually becoming mainstream. Mm-hmm. So against this kind of capture and co-optation of socialist degrowth ideas to far right and neoliberal ends, what kind of, you know, what's your theory of change? How do we get, because it seems to me that unless we get rid of profit altogether, and unless we get rid of GDP growth as a motive for any kind of economic activity, which means moving beyond capitalism, we're not going to achieve this kind of reduction in throughput that we need and energy demand that we need. And that just seemed like it seems like an insurmountable, you know, hurdle to cross at this juncture. So how do you get there, and can you get there with small but decisive steps?
Yeah, that's a tough one indeed. Yes, that's a good question. So the long-standing debate on the growth imperative of capitalism, that's something that I must say I think it's something that has been neglected in part of our research and our analysis, because of let's say different positions that there are within the degrowth community vis-a-vis capitalism. I think that surely what the eco-socialist discourse can bring to our degrowth thinking is absolutely the need for socializing the commanding heights of the economy, in the sense that those sectors that those economic activities that are essential to provide the basics of life should not be subjected to a logic of constant expansion. Then if we think in terms of some sort of localized, small scale private initiative, whether that would entail some constant need for expansion, it's really moot point. I would personally struggle to answer that, in the sense that growth is the child of capitalism, but growth has outgrown capitalism. Growth has colonized also socialist thinking in terms of the economies. And indeed, we have seen that socialist countries have pursued growth as much as capitalist ones. So I think that here there is some questioning to be done on just not on the forms of private properties, but also some form of social pursuit. I would say that then if we are contending, let's say, we are contending with ecofascists and their vision of some sort of lifeboat ethics, you know, like this is the amount of resources that there are in the world, and hence the more people, the more scramble there will be for it. I mean, of course, population is one of the driving factors of environmental impact. But I think that the discourse we should embrace is not one of limits that are external, but rather of limits that are self-imposed, in the sense that throughout the history of civilization, I believe that meaning has been found in self-limitation, in the sense that every society has put certain boundaries to its desire for acquisition and for expansion and for increased in production. And it was exactly through those boundaries that meaning was set for society. So the whole idea of some sort of convivial form of dépense, convivial forms of expending, of wasting away, of expending the surplus, you know. I think that what capitalism has brought into the history, into history of humanity is this idea of surplus that will be further reinvested, rather than find forms in which this is just wasted. And so the whole Protestant ethic of further pursuit of profit rather than, you know, some sort of idle pursuits that was entertained by the aristocracy before the dawn of capitalism. So I think that we should refuse this idea of some sort of external limits, and hence, you know, we all want more, but there are some limits, some sort of external biophysical limits, and hence the fewer of us, the better it is, so that each one of us can have more. I think we should embrace a deeper reasoning, and the one of just imagining some forms of self-limitation, of creating some sort of like frugal abundance in which we can think in ways of not maximizing our consumption and therefore our production, but rather maximizing relational goods, free times, human relationships. So I think that's really the ground on which we will fight ecofascism, and not on the ground of just having some sort of simply having some better policies to address these biophysical limits. I think we should contend the reading that they give to the situation we are in, and not just what solutions we propose. I think that also the reading is very important.